stupid. He comes across in front of me every single time he overtakes. Where does he want me to go off the track?
No!
Stop talking to me in the braking zone.
I have just one question for you all. Are you ready for Will Smith's Miami? Welcome back to Motorsport 101.
You are the world champion!
Hello and welcome. Today is May the 8th, 2018, is when we're recording this 138th episode of the Motorsport 101 podcast. This is going to be a bit of a different episode along with us. Of course, we have Ryan King joining us from the Bronx in New York. Hello, Ryan. Yeah.
Yeah, it feels so empty. It feels so empty.
Yes. Trust me, we know that MetLife Stadium is not very active around this time of year, but it'll pick up. I am, of course, RJ O'Connell from Motorsport 101's second American headquarters in Chattanooga, Tennessee. Where is Andre Harrison, you ask? Andre Harrison is not going to be on this episode. He has He has commitments with his family and he has commitments at work, so he is taking this episode off, but Dre will be back for this week's episode of Bike Live on motorsport101.net, which will be a very, very fun one as they're going over the MotoGP Spanish Grand Prix and all of its support events. Day of contrasting fortunes for Repsol Honda here. Marquez flossed and flew his way to victory, and Danny Pedrosa, well, you're probably wondering how he ended up in that spot. We'll get into that on this week's episode of Bike Live with Andre Harrison and Lewis Sutterby. But we are going to have a feature-packed show. We're going to talk about Formula One's proposed race in the city of Miami, Florida. And we're going to have a sports car extravaganza. Only three of them can make the cut, so we're talking about the 6 hours of Spa-Francorchamps. We're talking about the IMSA Sports Car Challenge at Mid-Ohio, and we're talking about Super GT's Fuji 500 Kilometers, the Golden Week Classic. It's going to be a great time, and definitely thank you so much for listening on motorsport101.net. You can listen to us on SoundCloud and on Apple Podcasts, whichever fine podcasting platform you support. You can find us on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101, our Twitter is motorsport_101. Our personal Twitter handles are at Harrison101HD for Dre, at Ryan Eric King for King, and at RJ O'Connell with two N's and two L's. And if you really, really like us and wish to support the show financially, you can back us on Patreon at patreon.com/motorsport101. Among the many perks, for just $5 a month, you can get early access to both this show and for Bike Live. And for $10, you can have access to the community Discord and listen in as the show is being recorded. It is a great time. Hello to our friends who are listening to the show here. And thank you very much, whatever you're listening live or on early access or when it comes out for the general public. Thank you so much for all your continued support. Right. So there's not a whole lot in Formula One happening as we lead up to the Spanish Grand Prix, except for the fact that there is a brand new venue coming to the calendar. We think it's going to be in the city of Miami. We're going to talk about it right after this musical interlude. Party in the city where the heat is on, all night on the beach till the break is
gone. Welcome to Miami. Bienvenido a Miami.
Bouncing in the club where the heat is on, all night on the beach till the break is gone.
Hey, King, what do you know the city of Miami, Florida for?
I would say I would know them best for NBA players buying out an hour of airtime to announce that they're going to Miami, Florida.
Right. They had a pretty good football team 1 year, didn't they?
Yeah, that 1 year where they ran the table and went undefeated. And, you know, it created a movie franchise involving a pet detective and other stuff.
Yeah, a great movie franchise, which, you know, let's not mind the fact that some of that really, really aged bad.
Yeah.
Yeah. What else is Miami notable for? Dwayne The Rock Johnson, and also his alma mater, the University of Miami, which were the ultimate college football team way back in the day. Entertainers Pitbull in Florida, who seemed to headline every other year's WrestleMania concerts with like five different theme songs that they've chipped in just for the event. And pretty soon, as we learned over the past week, it may soon be host to a Formula One Grand Prix event in the middle of downtown Miami. The following statement follows from Sean Bratches, the Managing Director of Commercial Operations of Formula One. Earlier today, as in May 2nd, 2018, the City of Miami Commission took an important step by adding an item to their upcoming agenda that, if approved, will make way to bring Formula One to downtown Miami next season. We appreciate the community's interest in hosting a Formula One race and look forward to working with local officials and stakeholders to bring this vision to life. With over half a billion fans worldwide, Formula One is the greatest racing spectacle on the planet. Miami's status as one of the world's most iconic and glamorous cities, combined with its robust tourism infrastructure, makes Miami the perfect destination for Formula One and its fans. Again, these are all from Sean Bratches, the Managing Director of Commercial Operations for Formula One, who is very, very excited about the potential of a Miami Grand Prix on the calendar starting in October 2019. King, what was your reaction when you first heard this news?
I would say instantly a bit sad, because knowing that Miami is getting a race, New York definitely won't be getting a Grand Prix. And I see the reasons why New York isn't getting a Grand Prix. We're really close to Montreal and various other reasons. But secondly, I'm kind of excited.
Yeah. For reference, this would be the first Formula One race held on a street circuit in the United States since the ill-fated United States Grand Prix that was held in Phoenix, Arizona. Now, if you remember the Phoenix Grand Prix, you remember it for one of two reasons. Either that's the race where John Alesi had his breakout performance in the Tyrrell in 1990 and damn near stole a win off of Ayrton Senna at his prime. Or you remember it for the 1991 race that was so sparsely attended that urban legend decrees that it was once outdrawn by an ostrich festival in the same city. But this, I don't think it will have much trouble drawing a crowd. It's Miami. It's one of the most happening places, not just in the United States, but potentially in all the world. There's a lot of nightlife, so you'll never be bored. And the track layout itself, we've got some comments about it. It'll pass by some landmarks, but man, King, fair to say that if you look at this track layout that's been proposed by numerous outlets, would you need to see a doctor if you look at it for more than longer than 4 hours?
Yes, you would definitely need to go see a doctor, because you need to make sure that that's okay.
Yeah, you definitely don't want, well, let's just examine this layout. They're taking inspiration from the track that many now fear. And that's the crazy thing, is that we now fear that it's going to replace the prestigious Azerbaijan Grand Prix of Baku. But there will be elements of Miami street races past and present. Now, fans know that Miami recently held a Formula E race in its inaugural season. Before that, Miami had on and off dalliances with street races for the CART / Champ Car World Series, last running in 2003. Those races were centered around Biscayne Boulevard, which is a major thoroughfare. And this proposed Miami circuit layout will run through not just through Biscayne Boulevard, but also through the Bayfront Park. It's going to run through Bayside Marketplace, which is a big shopping center. It'll run through Port Miami to cross this bridge that goes right over the port. And it'll also bypass the American Airlines Arena, home of the Miami Heat. This is a rather divisive track layout, though, shall we say, mostly because of the long run up down the bridge and then this hairpin section that curves and goes right into the other lane. Shall we say it looks what's the word I'm looking for, King?
phallic?
Yeah, I wasn't actually going to use phallic, but that's, I mean, there's no cut and dry way around it. I've heard comparisons to the Ava circuit in Germany.
I have issues with that comparison.
Go ahead, King. Lay it on me.
Well, the Avis in Berlin, that was, again, a street circuit. Well, it was mostly a street circuit with a huge bank corner. They were planning on building a southern bank corner, but obviously the Second World War stopped that. And I would say, arguably, if it had continued in its original form, it would probably be the most dangerous racing circuit of all time. So, right. Comparing it to the Avis is not a good comparison. It's not a good comparison.
Right. It's definitely unique in the sense that the Pontiac Aztec is a unique car. Again, we don't know how this is going to race, because what we're going off of is we're going off of a Google Maps sketch of what the track might look like. This proposal does have some serious heft behind it, because Stephen Ross is the owner of the Miami Dolphins, who is putting in a lot of money. And again, this is all pending a public vote here. If the public decides to go ahead with it, there
will
be
it's not up to a public vote. It's up to a vote by the Miami City Council.
Oh, okay, I see. I forgot one step of the bureaucratic process. It's fine.
Yeah. So I assume Stephen Ross has a good relationship with the city of Miami, because he is probably one of the staunchest owners in the NFL when it comes to, in terms of relocation and community outreach. He's been very adamant that he's not going to move the Dolphins out of Miami. Also, he was the only NFL owner to vote against the Oakland Raiders moving to Las Vegas.
Right, so fair to say that if Stephen Ross does get his wish and he does get this race to go into Miami, fair to say he's going to do everything in his power to try and keep this race as long as it is financially viable. Yes. He says, from football and soccer to tennis and motorsports, Miami deserves only the best in music, food, art, fashion, and sports and entertainment, and that is exactly what we plan on delivering with a Formula One race. The proposal being voted on next week will see the proposed Miami Grand Prix run for 10 years.
Which is insane. You rarely ever hear a city getting a 10-year contract for a race. Like, most recently, the New York City E-Prix has a 10-year contract for Formula E. And that, again, that's iffy on that part, if that contract will run the distance. But a 10-year contract to host a Formula One Grand Prix, that is unheard of.
Yeah. And I think it's also like a reflection of the changing attitude between the change of ownership between the Carey, Bratches, and Braun era compared to the Bernie era, who Ecclestone had a very short-term view in regards to race in the United States. With Carey and Bratches and Braun at the helm, I think they're looking at this more of a long-term deal. Yes, America's motor racing scene is still dominated by NASCAR and IndyCar, but in light of recent news, with the news that the France family might be looking to sell the family business, there is an opportunity for Formula One to get a serious foothold that it hasn't had in the country in arguably about 50 years.
Yeah.
Chase Carey told ESPN, adding a destination event in a city like New York, Miami, or Las Vegas, that raises the profile and helps people engage. Doing more online so that people can get closer to the sport, realistically at the core, that is engaging fans, and it's engaging in different ways.
Though I'd say the one thing about this Miami race, the best thing to help it actually come to fruition is probably the worst aspect of this race. The fact that, one, it's centered around that Miami is a destination city, that, you know, people are going to come to this race because it's in Miami. Because of that, the circuit has to be located in pretty much the middle of downtown Miami, which is, as we see by the circuit layout, not the most... It doesn't create the best possibility in terms of a really creative racing circuit. Like, The bridge circuit is, I would say it's okay. The bridge is by far wide enough. It is 10 lanes wide, three lanes in each direction with two hard shoulders on each side. It's by far wide enough to actually do this well.
Yeah, that's the thing that these Google Maps don't tell you, is that this bridge is massive. They are not going to have the sort of problem like you have at the castle at Baku or in some of the parts of Singapore where you go across the bridge. Oh no, there is plenty of real estate to race, and that means these are going to be some wide-ass open DRS zones. Assuming that's still a thing by the time this comes into fruition, it's going to be a thing by the time this comes to be.
Well, there's going to be DRS next year, which they kind of said is going to be the first year of this race.
Yeah. So, what would Miami mean for the future of the United States Grand Prix COTA? What do you think would happen with that? The contract runs until 2022. It's got a fairly secure place in the calendar, though disappointing ticket sales and uncertainty over local government funding. They've gotten over that. They've got concert every year. But where would Miami fit in with that?
That is probably my largest worry, because right now the plans for this race is to host a Miami Grand Prix would likely be in October, either most likely slotting in right before the United States Grand Prix.
Right, and then that begs the question of where do you slot in Mexico City, and then how do you turn that around from the leg where you go from Singapore, from Russia to Japan, and then turn around and go right back to North America?
Well, the widely circulated rumor is that the Azerbaijani government have already sold safety equipment to the city of Miami. So, in theory, it seems like Baku might not even be on the calendar. And then that would leave space on the calendar for Russia to move back to the spring.
Right, and that's the craziest thing. Like, if you had told us, any one of us, that by the time Baku came off the calendar, we'd be pretty sad about it, you'd have been lying. Because Baku's coming off of two very entertaining, debatable on whether or not you call it good, but they were entertaining races to make way for Miami, which, again, honestly, it's going to be a much bigger market. The potential for a race in Miami is a lot bigger than it is in Baku.
And I think time zone wise, it's going to do wonders. If they host it, like, you know, around 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, it's in prime time in Europe.
Yes, that would be absolutely perfect. Other races that might potentially fall off the calendar to make way. Hockenheim, Spa-Francorchamps, and Suzuka, the latter two, I don't think they're coming off. Hockenheim's at the most risk because we know Germany's has been, shall we say, on and off in recent years.
Though Liberty Media have been pretty much adamant that's like, don't worry about us adding Miami and races in Asia. We still want to keep the tradition in Europe alive, which, to me, the tradition, like, traditional, there are five races in Europe that you can't drop from the calendar. French Grand Prix, German Grand Prix, Belgian Grand Prix, Italian Grand Prix. British Grand Prix is a soft fifth, but yeah.
Yeah, well, see, the thing is, they've dropped three of those five that you've just mentioned.
Yeah.
Some for stupider reasons than others. If you'll recall, the French Grand Prix did not have a home until this year, because Matticor was way in the middle of absolutely nowhere, and Paul Ricard was not ready to host an F1 race. And arguably, it may still not have the infrastructure, but hey, it's a Formula One race in France again.
Yeah, I mean, I think that was one of the biggest reasons to me why Miami is a lot more appealing than Baku. That the fact that Baku, I believe the maximum capacity was like 30,000 seats.
Yeah, it has the lowest capacity, and in fairness, people were thinking like, oh, it's a race in a country that I'm not familiar with. It won't draw 10 people. So, you know, you don't want to just build like 100,000 seats and have nobody turn up. So that was smart on their behalf.
Yeah.
Miami, I think we're going to see a whole lot more people. If this is successful, we're going to see this rival attendance that you would see at like Long Beach, for instance. or any other iconic street race. There's definitely a lot of potential here. Will it come to fruition? Well, the city council's got to vote on it, and if it does, we'll definitely see how it races, because yeah, it's going to look like an entertaining venue.
I'd probably say when Stephen Ross wants to do something, he'll get it done, and it's pretty much down to the city council, because... So, RJ, you've heard of the International Champions Cup, like the now almost, I wouldn't say iconic, but it is now a perennial part of like the international soccer calendar, where you have teams coming over here to the United States for preseason tournaments.
Oh, yes, I am familiar with that. They'll basically have all the top European teams going to the United States.
The company that organizes that competition is run by Stephen Ross.
Yeah, that's another big sporting impact that Ross has already given us to the American sporting landscape. Not just the Dolphins. You know, this is looking like it's got some legs. Now the big question is, and I believe the most pressing question of all, which Miami or Miami adjacent celebrity is going to be the grand marshal for this race?
I want to say solely due to his connection to the Fast and Furious movies, it has to be Dwayne The Rock Johnson.
I don't think there's any other choice. I mean, he's not going to get called out on by Smash Mouth for certain bedroom activities like some other rappers in the business. God, it's surreal. That's surreal to think. Probably Pitbull in a close second.
Yeah, it'll be Pitbull. Pitbull is guaranteed to have a concert within the first 3 years of this race.
And hey, how many kilometers are in a Formula One Grand Prix? 305. What's one of Pitbull's many nicknames? Mr. 305.
Yeah, because that's Miami's area code.
Wonderful. October 2019, the projected date for the inaugural Miami Grand Prix, but of course this is still pending the city council vote. This will be a story we're going to watch, especially as we get nearer and closer to the reveal of the 2019 Formula One and FIA calendars.
Yeah, I have one last question before we head off to the next segment. Do you think we could end up back in Malaise era Formula One, where we have three United States Grand Prix?
I think that's the goal that Liberty Media want to achieve, because they have been pushing U.S. expansion hard.
Yeah.
And I would not be surprised if they try to wedge in a third U.S. Grand Prix event at somewhere, be it at another street course, like in Las Vegas. Although I've surveyed the scene at Las Vegas. At least around the new football stadium and the new hockey arena, I'm not sure where you're going to run there.
Yeah, compared to what Las Vegas was in the 70s and like the early 80s when they ran the Caesars Palace Grand Prix, it was literally, the strip was literally, you know, where all the casinos were, and then pretty much 2 to 3 blocks behind each casino was just like a sea of parking lot.
Yeah. Which contributed greatly. Yeah, it contributed to the malaise of the Caesar Palace Grand Prix.
And like none of that exists anymore. Now it's like all like random subdivisions now, which partially caused the Great Recession. But we'll move on from that.
Right. We'll move on to that, and Oakland will move on from its football team for a second time coming soon. Let us then take a quick pause, then, and we'll jump right into our sports car extravaganza. Because if it has wheels and an engine and they keep score, it's blatant gimmick infringement on our behalf, and we apologize. This is our sports car extravaganza portion of Motorsport 101. This is one where we kind of just, if Dre was here, he was just going to be like, okay, kids, have the wheel. Dad's going to go have a nap in the backseat of the car.
Yeah, don't be like Pietro, sorry.
Right. So let's start off with that. When we got the news that during Friday qualifying, Pietro Fittipaldi broke both of his legs in a qualifying crash during the 6 hours of Spa. Pietro was driving for the Dragon Speed Racing Team, their first drive with the Dallara-built BR Engineering 01 chassis, when it looked as if the car had just completely straight-lined at Eau Rouge and impacted the wall head-on. Now, it didn't look like that bad of a hit, but it was clear that something was very wrong when he wasn't getting out of the car. There wasn't a lot of updates for a while, and then we found out from an official FIA press release that Pietro Fittipaldi had suffered fractures in both of his legs because of this hit.
Yeah, that is, like, something that you would see in, like, the early 80s, where the leg still extended beyond the front axle, where it's like, yeah, head onto the wall, he definitely broke both his legs. Like, no, we don't really expect to see injuries like that nowadays.
It was a very, very frightening scene, and I think we're all very glad that Pietro Fittipaldi for the most part is going to be okay for this, but that does severely ruin what it was going to be a great season for him. He's of course well, and his condition is stable. He had operations on both of his legs. He had a complex fracture in his left leg. His father was with him throughout the night, and of course Pietro is on his way back to recovery, but this is going to be a long recovery that will unfortunately mean that in terms of IndyCar news, Pietro Fittipaldi is going to miss his very first Indianapolis 500, where he was set to drive the number 19 PaySafe Dale Coyne Racing entry for that team. And he was looking every bit like he could be a solid contender in that race. So yeah. That, of course, created a knock-on effect of who is going to drive that number 19 car.
Yeah, for the second time in 2 years, Dale Coyne has pretty much a race-winning platform, and they lose a driver to a serious injury.
And this one not even at Indianapolis 500 time trials, unlike Sebastian Bourdais last year. Things would not get much better. In the days before this, the team that is colloquially known as Manor, but is officially known as... Jesus, I can't even remember the name. It's very much a combination of alphabet soup here.
Yeah, I gotta check this out, because I was like...
It is officially entered as CEFC TRSM Racing, but you may know them as Manor. 4 days ago, the news withdrew that Manor was forced to withdraw from the weekend's event due to cash flow problems. In a statement from the team that says the required funds for Ginetta were due some time ago, and whilst we understand that TRS, the Chinese firm that basically are the team's main sponsor, has been working with its sponsors to short the issues, without payment, Ginetta cannot allow the cars to race. It added that Ginetta remains committed to working with Manor and that the current situation is a short-term cash flow problem that should not affect its participation in the Le Mans 24 hours. King, do you think it's a short-term issue, or is there something more sinister lying beneath the surface of this press release from Ginetta?
I don't know. Like, I assume we'd have to wait until Le Mans comes around to really know. But it's like, I hope it's just like a short-term issue and just preparing myself for it to be the worst.
Right. So out of all of this, that puts three LMP1 privateers on the back foot on a weekend where everybody was fearing that the whole of the LMP1 privateer grid was going to be on the back foot because equivalence of technology has been implemented. There are provisions that the LMP1 privateers have to remain competitive in comparison to Toyota, who are the only factory team and the only hybrid in the field. But then you look at things like the rumors that the WEC was going to give out one lap stop and hold penalties if they dare go faster than an LMP1 hybrid, or the fact that they had instituted maximum stint lengths of 17 laps compared to Toyota's 19, just on the week of the race. So if you look at it very cynically way, you might think, well, Gerard Nouveau really just wants Toyota to win every race. And as the race developed, yep, Toyota did lock out the front row provisionally until the number 7 car was disallowed from qualifying. So that meant that Sebastian Buemi, Kazuki Nakajima, and wait, who's that Spanish dude with the long hair and the beard? Is that Jesus? No, it's Fernando Alonso when he starts his first WEC race from pole position. Yeah, and so that happened. Sebastian Buemi started the race and quickly went to putting the field in a world of hurt, shall we say. The number 7 car was due to start from the pit lane one lap down because it was thrown out of qualifying. It took them by the halfway point of the race to catch up and get to second place. But in the end, Toyota just simply dominated the race. They took a 1-2 finish, the number 8 of Alonso, Buemi, and Nakajima finishing ahead of the 7 of Mike Conway, Jose Maria Lopez, and Kamui Kobayashi, just 1.4 seconds between them in what was a bit of a stage finish, shall we say?
Yeah, it seems so, like... I see some people getting upset about saying, oh, there shouldn't be team orders. I'm like, this is endurance racing. You kind of, like, team orders are completely necessary.
Right. Yeah, and it's just like, now team orders are bad. After a week ago, we were just like, well, why didn't we have team orders earlier? I mean, granted, it is also, like, you know, I kind of see the point that, like, okay, Toyota's pretty much going to be the only realistic factor. They should at least let their cars fight for the win. But at the same time, they have a championship to worry about, and they would rather, like, take the 1-2 finish, get the maximum points that they can, and just try and put this one to bed before they get to the race that they actually want to win, and that's the 24 hours of Le Mans.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure at Le Mans, like, definitely, they do not want their cars racing each other.
Right. Out of all this, it seemed like we have an intriguing... The best of the privateers was probably the number one Rebellion Racing Orica of Andre Lotterer, Neil Yachty, and Bruno Senna, which, if that was in, let's say, a factory Porsche, that's a team that could have easily lapped the field.
Yes.
As it stands, I mean, their pace was still good, and I want to kick this over to some of the analytics done by the folks at the B-Pillar. Because we're gonna try and unpack some of this this pace here. So Mike Conway, in terms of the fastest 30 laps that he did in this race, he was the quickest driver. Second, Kamui Kobayashi, and third was Fernando Alonso, the quickest driver in his car. Now the slowest of the Toyota drivers was Jose Maria Lopez. In terms of his average, he was doing about a 2:02.5. Andre Lotterer was doing about a 2:06 in a car that was consistently about 1.5 to 2 seconds slower throughout the whole of the race. And had probably no realistic chance of winning at this stage. Let's be perfectly honest with ourselves. So Andre and Neil and Bruno were just wheeling this thing. And then they got disqualified because they had worn out the safety plank under the car too much. But it's not all bad for Rebellion, because the 3 car of Thomas Laurent, Gustavo Menezes, and Matthias Besch did take up the podium. So we do have a privateer on the podium, Rebellion Racing standing out as the best of the rest in the field. And hey, things were good for Baikal's Racing too. Despite the fact that they clearly had the slowest car, their Nissan-powered prototype did not break down and they finished 4th.
What a world. The Baikal does not break down.
Yeah, it's looking like by manner of attrition, Baikal's just had a great, great weekend. And Tom Dillman did some serious work, putting in about 90 laps in the car. That's more than any other driver did during the race. Now, it was looking like there was going to be a third factor in this field, and that was the number 17 S&P racing car of Stefan Sarrazin, Igor Arujev, and Matevžos Izakayan. Until the second half of the race, where Izakayan's BR-01, this is the Dallara-built prototype that is partially designed by the Russians, we knew they had a big crash. And I had overheard that they had a much bigger crash than the cameras had let on, because the race cameras did not pick this up. Until we got some photographs that were released earlier today, and that Matevos Izakayan walked away from this. This was not good. It was not good that the nose of the car was completely ass over tea kettle at the top of Eau Rouge.
That is something that you rarely ever see, and you don't even want to even dream about seeing.
So the photo was taken by the folks at BelgianMotorsport.com. This is like the clearest image we have, because if you look to the left of one of the GTM Aston Martins cresting the top of Eau Rouge, you'll see that Izakayan's SMP racing car is already, it has its nose basically dug into the ground at this point, and it's about to flip over twice and land on the top of the tire barriers at the outside of Eau Rouge, about where Kevin Magnussen came to a complete stop in 2016 when he wrecked. Remember, folks, Eau Rouge is not dangerous after they paved over the runoff.
Yeah, that is...
So now, King, we have what may be a serious problem that's affecting one-third of the grid, who are all using the same BR1 chassis. Fittipaldi's crash didn't seem like it should have had the outcome that it did, and now, obviously, one of their cars is just blown over at the top of Eau Rouge. If anybody knows anything about the history of Le Mans, you'll know that sometimes cars are prone to go airborne at the end of the Mulsanne Strait. You only have to ask when Peter Dumbreck, who flew right into the trees in 1999, and then they had to literally smooth out the road to prevent anything like that from happening. And even then, you could still catch air. Ask Alan McNish in 2011, who nearly vaulted in the grandstands in his Audi, or Anthony Davidson, who got sent airborne by a Ferrari in 2012.
Yeah, because these things are like, LMPs are just like massive aerofoils.
Yeah, and when they get airborne, it's not going to be a rough landing, let's just say. Obviously, glad that Matevos is okay, but this leads to like a potential worst-case scenario for Le Mans, where if Manor don't get paid, if Dragon Speed are intent, because they have already said, Elton Julian, the team principal, has already said, we're not going to race with the BR01 until we get some answers on how this had happened to our driver. And now, potentially, there's the worry that both of S&P Racing's cars, including the one that is set to be piloted by Jenson Button, who is going to test the car later, you could be looking at, there were 10 cars entered in LMP1 for Le Mans. There could be as little as 5. In a worst-case scenario, by the time we actually get to Le Mans. The 2 Toyotas, the 2 Rebellions, and the 1 Baikal's Nismo.
Yeah, this is scary, where it seems like, in terms of readiness, there was a massive spread between the privateers that were ready and the privateers that were seemingly scrambling at the last minute to get something together.
I think they were all very ready. I just don't think... Manor, I think, were obviously behind the gun, and that's a real shame for the teams that they've assembled for the cars. I definitely hope they get out the track. S&B Racing seemed prepared, but my goodness, I don't think they could have prepared for their cars literally launching airborne and breaking people's legs. And then that leads into the whole thing where cynically reveal, well, why would the WEC make a big push to get privateers back in the sport only to game the system against them with equivalents of technology?
Oh, I don't know. It always felt like the super season was a throwaway season.
But there was, going into the season, I genuinely felt like there was an opportunity for the, I mean, my goodness, back in the days where the Rebellion LMP1s and the Baikal's LMP1s were getting boat raced by LMP2s, that was the thing where they were like, that's it, we have to have like a crisis meeting, a summit about the future of LMP1 privateer, and this is what they came out with. And honestly, does it look any better than what we had before?
Like, I still have that feeling that they're kind of treading water until the 2019-2020 season, that they're kind of like, it's going to take a while for us to get to our vision. We're just going to have one really long year to get the calendar to just where we want it to be, and then this is the new WEC.
Right. This, again, there is a new set of top flight regulations coming out in 2020. What will come out of that? Who knows? Hopefully it's something good. And this, it really shouldn't take, I know it's easy to look at this and think, well, this is obviously, well, they're trying to rig the races for Fernando. He did a very good job, all things considered. The sports car crowd was expecting, all right, well, Fernando's just going to get all the plaudits because he's the Formula One guy. But he was genuinely as quick as his more experienced teammates, Buemi and Nakajima, who need no introduction to diehard sports car racing fans. They're proven commodities, and that is definitely going to be a competitive team. But I certainly want to think that on the other side of the Toyo garage, they got to be thinking, like, we know we're fast enough to win this race.
Yeah, like, according to the B-Pillar, Mike Conway, fastest guy out there.
Yeah. So let's dive into the subclasses, which, if you're looking for silver linings out of the 6 hours of Spa, there are good ones. GT had a great race that came down to the final hour of the race. In the end, it was the 66 Ford of Olivier Plas, Stefan Mucha, and Billy Johnson Jr. of the good old USNA came out in a thrilling battle with the Porsches and Ferraris that went down, like I said, to the final hour of the race, and no dramas at all for the new BMW M8s and Aston Martin Vantages, which were making their series debuts. It seems like GTE always has to come up in the clutch when the top classes just kind of seem to fall flat in their face.
Yeah, where it kind of feels like there's so much diversity of machinery in this class, but for some reason it feels like one, like, not across the entire season, but you roll up at a race venue and one car is clearly better than the rest.
Yeah, Olivier Pla made the move on Richard Leitz in his number 92 Porsche with 45 minutes left to go in the race, and Leitz was on worn tires that just couldn't hold up. Ultimately, he slid off. Him and his co-driver slid off the podium, and it was an interesting day of two sides where the 66 Ford won the race, and the 67, which was driven by Harry Tinknell, started off in the barriers at about the same point where Fittipaldi crashed.
Yeah.
Yes. And even though, like I said, it wasn't a race where the Aston Martins and the new BMWs really shone, but they got to the end of the race with no major hiccups, and that's gonna bode very well for them. That's a good foundation to build upon. In terms of the fastest drivers of the car, it was Bruni who did the best average. It was a very, very closely matched field, but it was Bruni who was the fastest in the number 91 Porsche 911 RSR. Now we move up to LMP2, where we have let's say two of Formula One's more meme-worthy former drivers in the field.
Yes. Oh, dear.
And they had a pretty decent day, but I think first and foremost, we got to talk about how Jean-Éric Vergne just cannot stop winning. He just can't stop winning lately.
Yeah, it doesn't matter what car he steps into. He's just going to go out there. Doesn't matter how, but he's going to walk away at the race victory.
Jean-Éric Vergne coming off of his third win of the Formula E season, and he's probably about to seal up the championship in due time in Formula E, stepped into the number 26 G-Drive Racing Orica, which he shared with Roman Rusinov and Andrea Pizzatola, and went on and won the race for that team. And he had the second fastest driver average of the LMP2 field, slightly slower than Guido Vandergaarde, whose racing team Netherlands Dallara had some electrical problems during the race that ultimately affected their outcome in the event. And just ahead of, is that? It can't be.
No.
It is. After Jasmine Jafar in third place, it's Pastor Maldonado, who had the fourth best average. But this was pretty much G-Drive's race to lose. And I believe it was the it was there was some competition from the number 38 Jackie Chan DC Racing Team entry, but ultimately it was the 38 that came home in second ahead of the Signatec Alpine, the number 36 car in third, and J Drive pick up a win in LMP2. And also Aston Martin take a 1-2 finish in a GTM with the older Aston Martin Vantages, which still look very, very good.
Yes, if I do say so myself. They still look competitive despite being old.
Yeah, and there was almost an upset in GTM because the new to the category TF Sport team damn near won it off of the factory Aston Martin of Paul Dallolana, Pedro Lamy, and Matthias Lauda, who've been bossing this category for a couple of years now. It's the 98 Aston who takes it over the number 90 TF Sport Aston, but it was still a very good race and just an extension of what we've already come to expect out of the GT class at the WEC. So all in all, WEC sounded like it was a mixed bag at Spa-Francorchamps in the first race of the Super Season era. Does that sound about fair, King?
Yeah, I mean, that's... Besides Le Mans, you could always expect a WEC race to be a mixed bag, where some classes provide excellent racing, other classes room for improvement, and there's some up and down moments, but nonetheless, you're going to get a really good experience, you know, watching this race.
Right. And of course, Le Mans is next month. What can we expect out of the premier class? Will it be up to the lower categories, LMP2 and GTE, to steal the show once again? Will this finally be Toyota's year, and how will people react to it if it is? All of that will be answered on a future episode of Motorsport 101. Now, we should probably cut it back to something that's in a bit better health, shall we say? Yep, that's right. It's time to go IMSA racing. It's time to go to Ohio. Oh, baby. IMSA had the Acura Sports Car Challenge at Mid Ohio, a 2-hour 40-minute race. So if the 6-hour epic that was Spa-Francorchamps was a bit too long for your taste, this one I feel was just about the right size.
Yeah.
Mid Ohio's first premier North American sports car race since 2013. That of course key because it was the last year before the merger, and this was a weekend where IMSA had the headline. It was not going to be sharing the bill with IndyCar. It had to be its own showcase. And boy, did it deliver, especially if you were driving a car that was badged by the race's sponsor. Right. So it starts on Saturday when Elio Castroneves, who I should remind everybody, one, he's not retired. Second, he's still fast. And three, he hashtag still has magnificent hair.
Yeah, that'll always be a thing.
Elio Castroneves and his magnificent hair took pole position for the number 7 Acura DPI that he shares with Ricky Taylor. And from there, they just kind of book it, shall we say. Acura, Team Penske, we knew that they were building up to something great. And this was the race where... be it because they finally got the package all settled, or because conspiracy theory time, it's because they're sponsored by Acura. They have Acura cars. X-Files theme intensifies. Elio Castroneves and Ricky Taylor did pull off the victory, and they got Juan Montoya and Dean Cameron in second. So it's an Acura Penske 1-2 finish at Mid-Ohio. It's Elio Castroneves' first IMSA win in a decade. Because he did some part-time duties for IMSA back in the days of Penske's Porsche program.
Never forget.
God, I miss those.
The RS Spyder was so good.
The RS Spyder was so good that it could beat LMP1 cars. Man, I miss those days. But these are still good. Ricky Taylor was once again fastest, again, owing to the wonderful nous done by the folks at the B-Pillar. Ricky Taylor averaged quicker than any other driver in the field. Second place was Pipo Derani in a car that was not competitive all weekend. Again, if you want a quick and consistent driver, you go with Pipo Derani, who pretty much got the best out of a woefully uncompetitive ESM Ligier Nissan. And speaking of cars coming good, we were wondering when Mazda and Team Yost were finally going to get it together, and they finished 3 and 4 and got one of their Mazda DPIs on the podium.
Yeah, that to me, that was probably the biggest story of the weekend, how competitive the Mazdas were. Like, Penske, you knew that they were going to be competitive because they qualified. Both their cars were half a second quicker than the other DPIs.
Oh, yes, indeed. And that was again, the breakthrough moment that I think Mazda and Team Yost were waiting for as well. They did so much ever since they pulled out halfway in the season and basically changed hands of the entire Mazda prototype operation from Speed Source to Yost Racing. And now it's starting to show. Now they're starting to find the confidence. I believe it was the 77 of Oliver Jarvis and Tristan Nunez who finished the race in third. The 55 was competitive. I should retract myself in saying that they finished third and fourth. The 55 was knocked out. Poor Spencer Pigot and Jonathan Barbarito. They had a good chance to be competitive for a podium, but that's still a great result. And Felipe Albuquerque and Joao Barbosa in the number 50 on the number 5 Action Express Mustang sampling Cadillac DPI VR did get some good points in fourth ahead of the Taylor and Van der Zanda Wayne Taylor Racing Cadillac. And that was prototype class, which looks like it's in much better shape competitively than the top class in WEC right across the Atlantic. And guess what? The GT classes are still very competitive. Although this was all Porsche all day long. Lawrence Vantor and Earl Bamber just crushed the field, winning the race by somewhat deceptive margin of 1.6 seconds. But it looked like it was Porsche's race to lose. Connor DeFilippi and Alexander Sims finishing second for BMW. That, I believe, is their best result of the season. And third was Antonio Garcia and Jan Magnussen in the number 3 Corvette. So once again, GTLM, even though one team clearly has the advantage up at the head of the field, it's always going to provide good racing.
Yes.
Always. You never have to worry about GTLM throwing up a shit show. And of course, nobody is ever mentioning balance of performance. Nobody is mentioning safety cars getting in the way and jumbling the field all up.
Wait, besides like the start, I believe, were there any safety cars during this race?
No, there was like one minor incident at the start of the race when the 85 JDC Miller prototype got punted off the road, and that was about it.
Yeah, like, for the amount of cars that they run in this championship at a circuit as, you know, tight and compact as Mid-Ohio, I'm surprised they ran the whole thing without a safety car.
Oh yeah, dude, this track is narrow and it's demanding, and the gray bits are where the track is, and where the green bits are not where the track is. And it's a real racetrack.
Tiff Goodell, Circuit 28C.
Right. out of all this, we had a clean race and no grief when it came to traffic. GT Daytona, out of all of this, it seemed like it was a long time coming, but Lexus won. Dominic Baumann and Kyle Marcelli taking the first win in IMSA competition for the Lexus RCF GT3, and it was a nail-biter of a finish at the end because it looked like Alvaro Parent and Catherine Legg were about to break Lexus hearts at the very end because Parent put on a massive charge in his Meyershank Racing Acura NSX GT3. Catherine Legg had done her part to put them in contention. Parent was just running them down. But ultimately, it was It was indeed De Bauman and Marcelli who held them off by just 0.2 seconds to take Letts' first ever IMSA victory with this car.
It seemed like that last lap, that it was leading down to that run to the line, that they were setting it up, trying to get a drag race finish, but they just couldn't get there, and the Lexus was able to stay ahead.
Chris DeHard got our buddy Chris got a good vantage point of the finish itself, and it looked like there was just nothing between them at the end. That was good racing between those two cars, and what a result it was for Michael Shank Racing on what is essentially their home track in what was a program where we didn't know what to expect out of them, because, correct me if I'm wrong, are they still part-time?
Yes, Michael Shank Racing is technically part-time.
Yes, they're technically part-time, so this is not a full-season effort. This is their home race, and they wanted to get a good showing out of it, and boy, did they ever. And the Paul Miller Racing Lamborghini of Brian Sellers and Madison So rounding out the podium in GT Daytona. This is one you'll definitely want to watch back on YouTube. It was a fun race. It was a clean race. Go watch it on IMSA's official YouTube channel or listen on IMSA Radio, whichever you prefer. I thought it was a very good one. And of course, to see Elio Castroneves back in victory lane and just as happy as he's always been whenever he wins a race. I mean, my goodness, what a delight. We've skipped across the Atlantic from Belgium to the United States. And now we're going to skip across the Pacific from the United States to Japan, because who's ready to race on a Thursday night bleeding into a Friday morning, baby?
Yep, it was a whole lot better than Thursday night football.
Oh, God. But that's just like setting the bar right into the crust of the earth.
That is true.
The Autobac Super GT Series had its traditional Golden Week race, the Fuji 500 kilometers, on Friday, May the 4th, at Fuji Speedway, 110-lap race. It was a fun one, and out of it came the number 23 Nismo GTR of Tsuji Matsuda and Ronnie Chitarelli, taking the victory over the number 39 Denso Kabelkosar, driven by Heikki Kovalainen and Kamui Kobayashi. That's another Toyota top prospect, Shosu Boy, who was just absolutely on his game at his very first race in a GT500 car. They traded the lead back and forth. Quinarelli got a blinder of a start. He was third on the grid, but by the end of the first lap, he was already up in the first place. Kovalainen then made a charge, and he took the lead on lap 23, and it looked like they were going to hold that through the end of the race until the final round of pit stops. The Nismo GTR came in one lap sooner, got a better outlap than the Sard Lexus, and that proved to be the difference, as Quinarelli came out with a significant margin over Kovalainen in the final spin of the race. Kovalainen could not claw it back. That is their third win at this race in the last 4 years, and for Tsuji Matsuda, who drove a very solid middle stint, this is a milestone for him because it's his 20th career win. He's the first driver to break through in the 20-win milestone.
So he held the record, and he extended it.
Right. The overall leaderboard as of this round, Matsuda is at 20 wins. Yuji Tachikawa, who finished third for Lexus team Zent Ceremo, has 18 wins. Satoshi Motoyama is third with 16 victories, and Chinarelli is at 14 victories. He is now the winningest international driver in series history. But it was still a very good day for Lexus, who got four of their cars in the top five places, and Show Superboy again. This was his first time in a GT500 car. He did not get a lot of time in practice because practice was fogged out and delayed till the afternoon.
If you've seen any photos of the fogged out practice, there was like no visibility. Like, I wouldn't even say it was safe to ride a bicycle out there.
No, it was not. So practice got cadets down in 30 minutes. He did not run qualifying, so he had very little time in the car apart from what they ran in and as little practice and warm-up as they had. But while he is not quite as ridiculous as Shohei Ohtani, it was definitely showtime in the middle stint of the race because he just kept holding on to the lead for as long as he needed to give his team a chance to win. And this is another driver, it seems like Toyota does not churn out a bad prospect. We talk about how good Red Bull's junior team is. I would wager that Toyota has just as good of a junior program because they have three guys in Tsuboi, Kenta Yamashita, and Rotomo Miyata who are all like can't-miss stars of the future. And before then, they had Ryo Hirakawa as part of that Toyota Young Driver program as well. Tsuboi is a driver on fire, by the way. He's won his last 11 out of 13 All-Japan F3 races. And he started the season with two podiums in both classes of Super GT competition. That's very good.
Yeah, that is... ooh, that is incredible.
When even Heikki Kovalainen, a driver who has a lot of Grand Prix experience and has seen among the best come in his time, names like Lewis Hamilton and Sebastian Vettel, when he's saying that this guy's a star of the future, you may be kind to heed word. And it's going to be sooner rather than later before he finds his way to a GT500 car. Compared to the Nissans, who did very well, and the Lexus, who did very well, Honda did not do as well. The best Honda was in 8th place. Jenson Button and Aoki Yamamoto only finished 9th for their efforts, which is, hey, it's still solid points, but it's not where they'd hoped to be after finishing 1-2 at Okayama. And this considering that Honda's biggest gain had been at power, the horsepower really didn't come into their own, so I think it might have been just a matter of the car was just not well balanced for this track.
Yeah.
All of the full race will be seen on Nismo TV, and you can also watch the extended highlights on Jenson Button's YouTube channel. He had some very good comments after the race. He was very optimistic despite the tough time. They still got some good points, and they're coming at up to the next round at Suzuka, where they were the fastest in in-season testing on both days. So if you are very much pulling for the number 100 Rayburn sets, there are still good times ahead to be had. On to GT300, which is the more interesting of the classes sometimes. This was kind of a cakewalk race for the number 55 Autobax Racing Team Aguri BMW of Shinichi, Takagi, and Shad Walkinshaw. They took pole position. They pretty much led every lap apart from the pit stop cycles. And Shinichi Takagi taking his 19th career victory, making him the all-time wins leader in GT300. He surpassed his longtime co-driver Mori Onita, who held the record since 2004 at 18 victories with his last win coming in 2013. Now Takagi is the all-time wins leader, and he's still competitive, even going into his late 40s, approaching his 50th birthday. He's still a very quick driver. He might be one of the best of all time in terms of his out-and-out performance.
Yeah, and considering that it's, you know, GT300, he could probably, be there for, despite his age, be there for another 3, 4, 5 years.
When you consider that the top three in terms of wins, Takagi, Nita, and Nobuteru Taniguchi, they're all within 2 wins of one another, and they're all still in competitive cars late in their careers. Every one of them could potentially reach 20.
Yep.
It looked like they would have some competition from the number 61 Subaru BRZ of Takato Iguchi and Hideki Imauchi, who were going to race for the team at the Nürburgring 24 Hours. And then halfway through the race, the engine let go. This is the 4th mechanical retirement since the start of 2017 for the Subaru BRZ, which it has a very beautiful sounding and a very powerful boxer engine that was once used in the WRC cars. But it's starting to seem like maybe it's a bit of a fragile pain point.
Like, I'm relatively new to Super GT. I'm extremely new to GT 300. I'm like, I really like BRZ, so I was like, I'm gonna pick the BRZ to be my favorite. Little did I know that I'm gonna go through a whole lot of pain this year.
Right. Yeah. And to be fair, they are a team that's, you know, obviously they want to do successful, and they have had success before, but it feel like they're a team that's missing that extra element. They've had the resources and the drivers together to win multiple championship. I mean, for Christ's sakes, they are one of the few factory teams in GT 300 right now. But until they sort out the reliability, until they get some consistency in the car, they're not going to be championship contenders. They're going to be good for like a race win here or there, and that's really a shame because that's one of the more popular cars in the category. Though not as popular as the APR Racing Toyota Prius, which finished second. Yes, that of course is a Prius, a mid-engine Prius powered by Toyota's old LMP1 powertrain with a hybrid stuck in the back of it.
If that does not change your mind about the Prius, nothing will.
If that doesn't change your mind, if the fact that there is a car that is painted like the Mach 5 from Speed Racer that is in this field, nothing will. If that doesn't change your mind, if that doesn't change it, if the Hatsune Miku colored car that has won 3 of the last 7 championships, it has a Vocaloid character on every discernible part of its bodywork, if that doesn't change your mind, I don't know what will. Also, the new Nissan GT-R GT3 got a podium out of this race, and good for them. This was a fun race, and again, you'll definitely want to watch it back on Nismo TV and on Jensen Button TV, whichever you prefer. It's a good time. You may even hear myself get referenced at some point for not having a life, according to, and I can't believe I'm saying this, newly elected counselor Sam Collins, who picked up a victory in his local township during local elections in the UK. Just briefly, real quick, how did that end up going on the whole?
On the local elections or Super GT? Yes. Actually, I need to look up the results just to be sure that I'm not putting out fake news, because
that's fine. Apparently, I've heard that UKIP only has like 3 seats, and I believe it's not confirmed yet that just one of them is Farage's seat on Question Time.
Okay.
And even that's not safe.
Yes. So, looking at the results from like a top-down view, Labor now hold the majority of local seats. Like, they now hold 35%, which is like, the Conservative Party also hold 35%, but it's like they hold just a couple more seats more. Unfortunately, Sam's party, the Liberal Democrats, they have lost seats, but Sam, you won one.
That had to have been like the peak day that after the race was done, he found out he won the election. That's great. And then he proceeds to roast me over YouTube chat for not having life. In fairness, he's not wrong.
You're not wrong. You're getting roasted by politicians on the internet, RJ. This is 2018.
Yeah, what a world I live in. What the fuck? I clearly need some more to drink. What else did we miss? Kevin Harvick won a NASCAR race, and the France family might sell the sport. It's a big deal.
Yeah.
There's a Birmingham Super Prix that might be coming back. Remember the Birmingham Super Prix? For fans of motorsport in the mid to late 80s to early 90s?
According to one Graham Goodwin at Daily Sports Car, Jensen Button will be driving the BR1 at Magny Cours tomorrow.
Yeah, as I alluded to, good luck, Jensen. Please be safe. We don't want to lose you for Suzuka and the rest of the season.
Please don't get yourself injured in that Russian machine.
I'm still baffled for words as to how Dallara ends up building a car that's not safe.
I guess they just they just got all the documents for it and just built it to their specification.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Dallara has all the single-seater contracts because they have such a sterling reputation for building a safe car. Evidently, this is something that the LMP2-1 car has a glitch of its own where basically it will lose power momentarily. Then the power will come back on, but the power steering does not come back on.
Ooh, and that, I assume that's just understeer city.
Right, that actually hampered the Racing Team Netherlands in preseason testing, a.k.a. the team that Guido Bantergarde races for. And also, you mentioned our colleagues at dailysportscar.com. Last week, we did finish the piece about the 1998 Fuji disaster and the careers and lives of Tetsuya Ota, the man who survived one of the most unsurvivable racing accidents of all time, and the driver who helped shaped his life, the late, great Shinichi Imaji. It's a wonderful piece. It's a long one, because that's just how it be sometimes. Definitely check it out if you get a chance. It'll be on dailysportscar.com.
Yes. You highly recommend. Highly recommend.
Yeah. Even King's highly recommending here, so you know it's good. Even like genuine journalist types are recommending it. This is good.
Even politicians are recommending it.
Again, what the hell? What is our lives respectively? Our baseball teams are good again.
Alejandro Aigag is trying to buy all of Formula E for 600 million euro.
How did he come up with this much money? Okay, if you were to take a time machine back to about 2013, if you look up and down the GP2 series grid, and if you're thinking, right, there's one team whose owner is going to make a serious power play to be like a major game breaker in all of motorsport and buy some series out for nearly $1 billion. How many of you would have had the dude that's running Barwa Adats?
No one. No one.
Nobody. That was a decent team, but, you know, they're not like an ART Racing or a Dams. Shoot, that's the irony. They're going to outlast Dams.
Oh, my God.
Yes. Birmingham Super Prix is back. Alejandro Aigag has too much money. Maybe he could buy NASCAR.
Ooh, since it's that'd being be interesting. Floated around.
Anything else that we missed?
Ooh, I think we have everything covered. Pretty much everything we haven't talked about, we'll probably talk about next week's show, because it's more closely related to Formula One.
Right, because next week we are going to have a stacked weekend. We've got the pre-Day of Classics. We got the IndyCar Grand Prix of the Indianapolis Road Course. We have the Spanish Formula One Grand Prix. We have the 24 Hours of the Nürburgring,
which will feature a very interesting demo lap.
Oh, yes. It'll just be a demo lap, so it's not going to be full-on hog wild around the Nordschleife. C'est la vie, but hey, you do get the image of the 919 Evo going side-by-side with one of the Porsche 962s from it, the heyday, the one that set the lap record at the ring. So that's going to be very fun, at least. God, I really wish they would have taken it for a full-on attack lap, though.
Yeah.
I know it's like a million safety hazards waiting to happen.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure, like, Neil Yanni's like, I wish I could, but insurance-related reasons.
Yeah, Lloyd's does not have a policy that is big enough for this.
No. And I think Porsche, like, they already have the lap record there, so they don't feel like they need to break it.
Yeah, that's fine. That's perfectly fine, I guess. So yeah, Spanish Formula One Grand Prix, IndyCar Grand Prix of Indianapolis, plus our other support tickets. We'll talk a little bit about the 24 Hours of the Ring as well. It'll all be on next week's episode of Motorsport 101. Stay tuned as well for this week's episode of Bike Live on the Motorsport 101 Network, where we talk about the Spanish Grand Prix of motorcycles. A lot of stuff happened. Marc Marquez won. Marc Marquez is still very, very good at this thing. And Ducati are...
Man. If you're a Ducati fan and you haven't seen the race, just don't. Just don't. Just save yourself. Just don't.
Yes. Johann Zarco has a contract signed for a factory team in 2019, and Kanan Sefugalo is going to bow out after the World Superbike Super Resort round in Imola. I know, but that man put his body through so much. I'm barely even a super sport fan. Like, I'm not even going to pretend to be, but that dude was, like, money. And yeah. He's doing it in a country that is not much of a motorsport country.
No. I still remember he broke that public road speed record on a motorcycle.
Golly. That dude's a beast.
Yeah. Also, for this weekend's Spanish Grand Prix, in applicable markets, F1 TV Pro will be available.
Yay! Thank goodness.
Yeah, F1 TV Pro will launch officially, I believe, this Friday.
Right, so that as well is something to look forward to. So perhaps by the time you're listening to this, you'll already be binge-watching the entirety of the 2012 Formula One season, as you should, because that was one of the best seasons of recent memory.
Yes.
Right. So just one last bit of housekeeping before we wrap things up. Again, just to go over the places where you can find us, motorsport101.net. We are on youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101, twitter.com/motorsport101. And if you wish to support the show financially and be one of our fine Patreon backers, you can do so at patreon.com/motorsport101. Our personal handles for the crew: myself at RJ O'Connell, Ryan at Ryan Eric King, and the absent Andre Harrison, who will be back, at Harrison101HD. So for Andre Harrison, for Ryan Eric King, for everybody who's been listening in, I'm RJ O'Connell saying thank you so much, and we'll see you on the next episode. Later, y'all!
Sayonara!
Bye!